This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Travis Zadeh, who is a professor in the Department of Religion at Yale University. We'll be speaking about a fascinating book about a fascinating book called Wonders and Rarities, the marvelous book that traveled the world and mapped the cosmos. And of course, as you'll soon discover, by virtue of the content of the book and the book within the book, this podcast will certainly be cross-posted, if not guest-hosted, at New Books in Islamic Studies. By the way, this will be out in early 2023, and it's Harvard University Press. All the details in the podcast notes, as usual. Travis, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's such a thrill to be here. I'm really happy to talk with you about this book.
So first things first, tell us about the genesis of this project.
Yeah, so I came to this work through a very winding path, and this work is my book is a book about a book, and the way I came to the subject of my book, a kind of biography of a book, is through archival research that I undertook in various locations, working closely in Arabic, Persian, Turkish, Urdu manuscripts and lithographs. And so this book just travels everywhere. It's this book called Wonders and Rarities. And so it's almost inescapable in a way. And it is such a strange book in many senses of the word to our modern sensibilities. And so I thought you could tell a broader tale through the stories of this one work that traveled in so many archives across the world, yeah, and over history.
So this strange book, tell us a bit about this fascinating, alluring, strange book.
Right. It is a very strange book. It actually has strangeness in the title, in the sense of rarities. So I'm calling it Wonders and Rarities. The Arabic might be closer to, because it was written in Arabic originally, something closer to the wonders of things created and the rarity. These are strange oddities of matter's existence, which is a little bit of a mouthful, but it is strange, and it sets out to be strange in the sense of covering the whole wonders of creation, and with it, the strange diversity found therein. So it really is a panoply of the natural world, and we could think of it as a natural history.
So tell us a little bit, for perhaps more of our general audience, how is the book within the book structured, the book that you're studying?
Right. Yes, the book that within a book. So this one book of Wonders and Rarities. It was written in the eve of the Mongol conquest, and it's structured in a very scholastic way. So the thing that's kind of I think very exciting about this particular work is that it's written by a college professor, a professor in a madrasa, who is also a chief judge in a city outside of Baghdad called Wasit that no longer exists today. And his name is Qazvini, and his book is structured in a very scholastic way, coming out of a madrasa or collegiate education. And so it follows the cosmos above with the heavens and the stars, and it's very much a geocentric vision of the world. And then it gets into the minutiae of minerals, plants, animals on Earth, the sublunar realm, as it's referred to. And it's very much a classical model inherited from Aristotelian natural philosophy in very broad brush terms.
Is the book anomalous in its genre and its type? Are there others like
it? It's a great question. And indeed, there's so part of the bigger story I'm wanting to tell with this particular book, and there are other works like it that do circulate and circulate quite widely, but perhaps none with the same kind of renown as this particular book, this book by Qazvini called Wonders and Rarities. And this broader story I'm hoping to tell in the course of my own book, as it were, is this larger history of enchantment or various forms of enchantment that wrap much of the globe. So how it goes from how we go as moderns to understand the world kind of with the sun no longer orbiting the Earth, but at the center of our solar system, and with knowledge of the Western hemisphere. So the world, how do we go about understanding a world before Copernicus and Columbus, as it were? And this book, which is in a genre of others like it, perhaps tells that story like no other, because it just had such a long, enduring appeal. It makes its way all throughout South Asia, throughout the Indian subcontinent. It extends into Turkey. As I said, there's Turkish translations. There's later Urdu translations. So it's part of this larger network of learning that spans, we could say, from North Africa all the way to Bengal, in this Arabic cosmopolis. You could refer to it as that, or a large network of learning in Arabic letters that's rooted in natural history, but it's also a delightful set of stories and anecdotes that are woven throughout it. So it's both scientific and also, in many ways, a kind of popularization of scientific writing of the day. So there are stories and anecdotes that stretch the imagination, and that's where the strangeness comes in, really, is that we're also dealing with quite clearly accounts of the wonders of the world that are beyond the pale as moderns for us to really fathom as having any reality to them. So we're talking about the classical so-called monstrous races of antiquity that we see from Herodotus, you know, in the Ramayana, the Mahabharata. You know, there's a long tradition of writing about strange creatures. So, but here it's taken quite seriously and literally as monstrous races and figures and forms that are part of a larger cosmic order. So it's a fun work to think with in that regard, because it just rubs up against our modern sensibilities. Before Copernicus and Columbus, the world is so different in many ways. We could think of it in those terms too.
Aside from the content about giants, what other wondrous elements and tales, whether they're tall tales or not, might we find?
I mean, it's fascinating, because like our attention, and this book has received a fair amount of attention from art historians in particular. So it's not unknown to scholars of Arabic, Persian, Turkish, Urdu letters, certainly. And a lot of the attention in the modern period is focused on, like you said, the giants and the people with ears so big they can wrap themselves up in them as blankets. And of course, that has an Indian analog, very clear Indian analog, as do the creatures that are human in all form, except they have just one giant foot that they jump around on. And it turns out that they can run very fast with that giant foot. Of course, that's in Pliny's natural history, but you also have these kinds of figures in the Mahabharata in particular. And so you're talking about, in many ways, shared cosmographies of difference, of imagining the strangeness in the world at the edges of the margins of the inhabited Earth. And yet for Qazvini, that it's so fascinating that wonder the strange, the uncanny, you know, the perfect example are the things that are much closer to home for him. He turns, for instance, it's a very classical move, to the beehive. Contemplate the beehive, he says, right? How strange it is that a singular bee, you know, working in concert with all these other bees can be a laborer on this giant project of creating these perfect, you know, geometric shapes that a skilled laborer and an architect on their own couldn't really craft in the same terms. And so for Kazwini, wonder is not only, though it certainly is, a question of the far and the remote, but it's also very much about the near and the proximate. And in this way, his book is also, you could think of it as a kind of metaphor for thinking about emotions broadly and ways of knowing the world in very broad brush strokes. So it speaks to a history of emotions and a history of knowledge as well, and a long story of in philosophy on wonder. And yet wonder, of course, in the broader philosophical tradition, takes two, kind of bifurcates, and in one sense you get this Aristotelian model that Kazwini certainly inherits, which is that of it coming out of Plato and building in Aristotle's metaphysics of wonderment is not knowing the cause behind a given phenomenon, and wonderment ends in knowledge, right? It's the basis of philosophy, as Aristotle writes in the opening of the metaphysics. And because we're certainly aware of that idea of wonder as the basis of knowledge. And yet there's this other side of wonder. And this is what's so fascinating about the book, that for us as moderns, I think, we see wonder as also part of childhood, and wonderment as connected to childhood, and with it, with stages of human development broadly. And Kazwini kind of builds on this in certain ways, but this argument that wonderment is located in a medieval past or ignorance of the world is very longstanding. And it also forms part of Orientalist discourses, or discourses, writings about Orientals as being stuck in an age of wonderment, of ignorance of how the world works, as wonderment as this location of childhood. And so in this sense, Kazwini can tell both the story of wonderment in Islam broadly, but also the reception of works like this in the course of colonial modernity as emblems of Oriental ignorance and superstition. So it's a kind of double-edged sword in that regard, and it helps tell a much broader story of wonder in across Eurasia, of the history of emotions, the shared cosmographies that bind whole groups of people together, and the enduring appeal of a work like this all the way into the 19th century, that it continued to be printed clearly for the information, both pleasurable information, practical information, but also cosmological information of the world.
How do we know how this book was received?
Yeah, thank you. Its story of its genesis is fascinating in its own right, and part of my book is trying to untangle that story of its early reception and its composition. And also, so like you mentioned, my book is a mirror to this other work, and so I structure my own work in this tradition of a Persian tradition of a jawab, or response to an earlier piece of usually poetry. So, but here I'm thinking of my own book as a kind of response to Kazwini's book, which was received quite laudably. I should wish so much for mine, but that aside, it was dedicated to the highest levels of society, and clearly circulated amongst the ruling elite, and was a part of a book culture that was celebrated and cultivated by the state. And so the situation of its composition is so fascinating, because Kazvin, where he grew up, the city of Kazvin, the modern city of Kazvin, fell to the Mongol invaders in 1220 under Genghis Khan. And so Kazwini himself was just a teenager, and he fled with many of the other notables that escaped the conquest of the city. And then he lived on in the safety of Iraq until the and continued to thrive. But then Iraq itself, the Abbasids were conquered in, of course, 1258. Baghdad falls, and the Abbasid Caliphate falls. And there's a new government that's set up under the rule of Hulagu, the grandson of Genghis Khan. And this government is referred to as the Ilkhanids, goes immediately to work in cultivating the same networks of patronage and administrative structures that were in place beforehand. So there are certainly all forms of novel developments that take place under the Mongols, but there's also a profound continuity. And Qazvini goes back to his position in Wasit, the city on the Tigris, where he was a professor at a college, a head professor and judge, and he dedicates his work to the governor, no longer the caliph, but the governor under the Mongols of Iraq, Juwayni, this high-ranking governor. And it was a sumptuously illuminated work. So it took all forms of capital and resources to illuminate it. And by that, I mean filled with paintings and illustrations. So it really was a world within a book, presented to a world conqueror, in a sense, to somebody who sat in the highest echelons of the Mongol elite. And indeed, it continued to circulate like this in one track, which is the track of the courtly elites from the Ilkhanids all the way up to the Mughals, the Safavids, the Ottomans, and minor dynasties in between. Certainly the Timurids, not a minor dynasty in its own right, but it had this dynastic reception. But it also had a reception through madrasas, these institutions of Islamic learning throughout South Asia. We have village copies that are produced for notables, and so I mentioned that it's part of this larger network of Persian and Arabic learning that expands on the Persian side from Bengal to the Balkans, and then on Arabic throughout North Africa. And it was because it was so concise and well written, with kind of the latest forms of elegance and fine poetry delectable stories woven throughout it. It was really a book of incredible utility and also of entertainment at the same time. So it was received quite well from the beginning, and then just continued to travel. And it continued to travel as things change in the world profoundly, and with it, the cosmological picture that Qazvini's book tells. And so that's part of the kind of tension in my own book is tracking, using the story of this one particular book of the world to tell a broader tale about changes in knowledge and learning and affect of feeling and being in the world. And that story contains at the heart of it these ruptures of this age of exploration that we often refer to it as an age of exploration, that when the Western Hemisphere is just finally accessed by European explorers and merchants and conquistadors, and then of course Africa as well, and with it the rise of imperialism. And this book, of course, Qazvini's book has no knowledge of the Western Hemisphere, and yet his own natural history, as it was received in time, is updated with current maps. Maps that are kind of taking into account changes in geography and geographical knowledge. And so part of the larger question that I've been seeking to ask in this book is, how is it that structures of knowledge change and are received over time and continue and adapt in unforeseen ways? And so the continued appeal of a work like Qazvini's Wonders and Rarities is a testament to how classical learning itself could be kind of much more supple than we might imagine in its reception, and how it's kind of models a way of understanding new information about the world as it is uncovered.
Thank you for the rich response.
Yeah, very, very rich response. Yeah.
We'll turn more directly to your book in a moment. I'm glad that you folded in some of its aims in passing, but just one or two, I can't resist just talking about this book from antiquity for one or two more questions. And the question that comes to mind is, can we say this is a book about natural wonders as well as supernatural wonders?
Yeah, that's a great question. And indeed, it's precisely at the heart of the way we come into this, right? That angels in certain frameworks would be considered quite normal, and in say the frameworks of secularism would be considered kind of supernatural or paranormal or beyond the natural. And so part of the problem is wonder is itself a question of what is real, right? If we go back to that Aristotelian definition that we wonder at things we don't understand the causes of, like a phenomenon whose causes remain unknown to us. The question of what phenomena are real and not real is quite at stake and really at the heart of it. How is it that we're to know that jinn are real or not real? Jinn, of course, feature prominently in the Quran and in Muslim tradition, and from a modern secular perspective, they can be rationalized in a variety of ways, and they have been rationalized in a variety of ways. And so this book is filled with stories of jinn, for instance, and accounts of the powers of angels, the cosmic powers of angels. And we think of that as supernatural from a modern perspective looking at it, or secular perspective looking at it. And of course, for Qazwini, this was part of nature, right? This kind of forms part of how nature itself works. And nature does something very different for him than it does for us. Nature for us is, I often think of the word in a couple of ways, but one of it, the ways is as a kind of almost like ecology, the study of the ecosystem, the study of the natural world, as separate from the human-made world in some sense. So the sum total of things that are natural in nature. But Qazwini saw nature not in those terms, but rather as forces in an Aristotelian sense. So nature as force and disposition. And the forces in the cosmos, and rather what we call nature, he would call creation. And creation is, of course, a word that has a teleological argument packed into it. Who is the creator, if not God, right? So that the cosmos proceeds through a divine creator, and then creation is the result of the act of a creator, God, who has will and intention. And thus, the question is, what's beyond nature, as you pose it, is a theological question of profound importance. What is natural and what is not natural? What's paranormal? And indeed, this word strange, as I've said this word a couple of times, strange in Arabic, gharib, is a word that comes to mean the occult sciences, so the strange sciences, the paranormal sciences. And so fascinatingly enough, much of Qazwini's work is deeply interested in magic and what we might think of as the occult sciences. And it's precisely because these arenas of what from a modern vantage might seem as supernatural or paranormal or fictional, from his standpoint, are part of an enchanted cosmology.
I find this utterly fascinating for so many reasons. On the one hand, certainly through an Islamic lens, there's one creation from one creator, and so all things under the sun are generated by and are a part and parcel of the one emanation from Allah, right? So this is
right.
It's all creation. Whatever, whether it's normal or paranormal,
right.
There's one source of all things.
Right.
And so
right.
It's all part of his creation. On the other hand, even in a pre-modern context, one would imagine that the blurring of boundaries between the mundane and the paranormal would be enticing or jarring or fascinating even to readers of his time.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely right, that there's something exciting about it. Even if it's, even if it's naturalized, right? And I think that's part of the appeal of a work like this. I mean, there's many kind of reasons that this book had such a long afterlives, but I think part of it is the kind of practical utility, because it really, much of the book is occupied with a pharmacy of medicaments from plants, animals, and minerals, and that classical division of the cosmos and the sublunar realm, as it's referred to in the Aristotelian tradition of all things under the moon, as it were, and these physical substances in the world that include humans, and the world is part of this interconnected cosmos of creation, that the humans are stand as one kind of apex of that in this cosmology, but are beneath in this hierarchy of profit, certainly as the culmination of human potential in this cosmography as it's understood. And then beyond that, angels and where jinn exists, certainly is a question, but also the power of animals and plants and minerals is profound in this book, and Kazwini spends a good deal of time indexing all the various uses that you can put to, like, coriander or turmeric, for instance. You know, the array of spices and medicaments and unique properties at one's disposal and the kind of manipulation of those properties. It in many ways the book is also a recipe book for how to produce strange results through a variety of substances as well. And I think that also speaks to these blurred lines too, of between magic and medicine, or between magic and prophecy, or magic and science and religion, as it were. And in the modern period, those three categories are so clearly defined for us out of the frameworks of secularism, where science, religion, magic are all kind of viewed as separate domains that are indistinct from one another.
In addition to secularism, it seems to my mind, I mean, irrespective of the tradition, that this distinction is demarcated in modernity by materialism or empiricism.
Sure.
Measurability. Yeah. And so...
Well, that's right, that you could think of this as a coming part and parcel with colonial modernity too, as well. I think the story of the scientific revolution also coincides with the emergence of colonial powers, right? And how these things get put hand in hand, and with it, new ways of measuring and new ways of accounting. But I wouldn't undersell the empirical kind of appeal to that Kazwini evokes throughout, that these are tested kind of recipes from, you know, well-worn experience. And indeed, the much of the discourse about the wonders of physical substances kind of evolves empiricism, precisely, like, the only way to know is by testing and trying.
What I mean to say is the distinction between he's obviously a scientist as well as perhaps an occultist, you know. What I mean to say is that these categories would be in different works in different genres in our times by virtue of what we think of. There are works that are empirical. And then, you know, if someone's looking at the physical body and measuring that in medicine, that's an empirical, you know, medical science is amenable to empiricism. If one were to use a holistic model or an Ayurvedic model and bring in koshas that are beyond what we can discern and that are amenable to all sorts of extrasensory manipulation, then, but in this work, it seems that I think part of what's surprising is that, let me put it this way. Do you get the sense that he had direct knowledge of these realities and wonders?
That's a brilliant question. And I think I absolutely agree about the kind of complexities and interconnections as well. And the various forms of authority that a figure like Kazwini would have wielded in his own day. And I think it is useful to think of this as science and in a sense that pushes our boundaries of how we imagine science, you know, where it lies and how it settled it is. And certainly his own practice is fascinating, and we get insights and glimpses of it throughout the work, both in kind of references to, well, this has been tried, like, I've tried this, or experiences of working. He describes plagues of lotuses and how to deal with them and fend them off, and it suggests, you know, actual experience of things that he's encountered himself. Interestingly, that this work has a companion work to it that is on geography. So he has a whole cosmography, and that's this Wonders and Rarities. But he also has a gazetteer of geography that is also kind of filled with his own experiences. You get the sense very much so that he is interacting with wonder workers, the people that we would refer to as Sufis, and he uses that term, and so saints and Sufis that claim the ability to heal and to produce wonders, and he catalogs those in his geography, and he makes references to them in his own natural history as well. And so I think he is, we can get that from his own writings, that he's in contact with what are mystics, for want of a better word, mystics that are performing miracles that authorities that and he refers to several of his own personal experiences, and we also get this in the biographies of biographical accounts of Qazwini that he was himself part of orders of Sufi orders of the day, and so connected to these mystical currents of piety.
Fascinating. Now that we have a very good sense of this wondrous work of the ancient world, let's turn to this wondrous work of the modern world, your book about this book. We know what the topic of your book is, but what's the angle? What's the core argument or thrust of your work?
Right. So what I'm trying to do in this project is actually tell a much broader history of wonderment in Islam and in Eurasia and in so many areas where wonder has traveled in Europe. European history have been explored quite thoroughly, and there's a really good body of scholarship out there on wonder and nature, on this age of exploration that I'm highlighting, on the wonderment as itself an imperial process and an imperial forms of imagining space, but also of forms in medieval scholasticism in the Latin West of entertainment, but also pious contemplation. And so there's a fascinating comparative history to be done here. And there's work that is ongoing now and should continue to kind of develop on these connections between wonder in say the Latin West and the Islamic tradition and Sanskrit poetics, Asian cosmologies. There's something almost kind of universal about it, and yet there are also real kind of particularities too. And so part of what this book is about is trying to tell the story of wonder in Islam writ large, and to imagine the kind of uniqueness of this discourse, why it's so pliable, and why it's so supple and can be used and evoked in so many different registers over such a broad period of time. And that discourse is summarized in this expression, wonders and rarities, ajayib wa gharayib in Persian or Arabic or Turkish. And it's always the same phrase. And it's so legible, and it gives meaning to this book, but also gives meaning to a whole set of aesthetic dispensations and ways of imagining the world and our place in it, and the boundaries between the real and the unreal, and with it, the arena of fiction and pleasure. So I was using Qazwini's book as a kind of Trojan horse to try to tell this broader story about wonder and the particularities of it too, because it's almost the comparative can easily border on the banal in a way, because it's so universal that we all share it. There's even great work on wonder in primates and animals broadly. So in the history of emotions, humans certainly aren't the only kind of species to have feelings and to contemplate, and yet this. And so while we have wonder as this kind of almost universal feeling you could imagine, there's also, there's much to be said on the history of emotions. Of what makes them legible is precisely the specificities of their context and the ideological frameworks that animate them and give them sense. And in that regard, wonder in Islamic vocabularies is also a discourse about God and nature and potential and plurality and ambiguity. And it's a kind of discourse of ambiguity that is cultivated quite widely in Arabic, Islamic philosophical traditions and poetic traditions as well. So I think that this book is also an emblem for a certain sensibility of the world, of how to be and act ethically in a world of diversity and of inequality and of hierarchy, and how to navigate those spaces and navigate them with etiquette and with pleasure. So it's also very much a book of ethics and decorum as well.
How is your book structured?
Right. As I mentioned, I was very interested in doing something kind of lively and playful, because Qazwini's book is not only a natural history, but it is also, I think, an invitation to entertainment, an invitation to diversion. And so I wanted to keep that spirit alive and telling this broader story of wonder. So I structured my book in three parts, roughly modeling the three parts that Qazwini developed. So he has an introduction, and then he has the which is the first part, a very significant introduction. And then he has the upper atmosphere, so the celestial spheres, and then the lower atmosphere of the sublunar spheres. And those are the three main parts. And so in my book, I structure it with a story about Kazvini's life, so his life and times, and then a section on the book itself, on the natural history and its contents, and how do we understand its contents and its time. And then the final section on the reception of the work. So it's the kind of life and times and reception, as it were. But throughout it, I'm drawing on Kazvini's writings, and then the way this work was received across various empires and through broad changes and shifts and learning. So it's structured in this three-part way to tell a biography of a book, a biography of an author, but also the history of a set of ideas and ways of thinking in the world.
What with this sort of work, it might be a number of things, but what did you find most striking, intriguing, even challenging while doing this work?
Yeah, the challenge, I mean, in many ways, it's the archive is vast, and we are of an age that our resources and our methods and the materials that we have available to us allow us to tackle on a corpus of such magnitude, a body of text that's so widely dispersed, that we have increasingly, and I've seen it in my own life, of course, we've all witnessed the way that digitization and digital materials has transformed what we know of the past and how we can gain access to, in codicological terms, in terms of archives, to manuscripts. And so just the sheer breadth of the manuscript record was astounding, of the number of copies of this work. It really was a pre-modern bestseller, and that it continued to endure for so many years, and that it continued to endure right in the face of European colonial modernity and withering critiques of Orientalists and missionaries about the kind of backward state of Orientals, and that this cosmography and cosmographies like it were emblems of ignorance, of Oriental ignorance that had to be forgotten. So the fact that this work, written on the right after the Mongol conquest and continued up from the 1250s all the way into past the 1850s, right into the we have printings of it clearly that were meant for its, not just as a kind of artifact, but as a testament to a living tradition into the 20th century. So that was just kind of astounding. Like, how do you measure that? How do you give form to that and tell a story through it? And then finding along the way, there were just so many gems of things, like in an archive so diverse and so wide, a geographical region and historical frame, that to see the individual lives of the artisans and the craftsmen behind the manuscripts, the readers who wrote in the margin. So you really are interacting when you do a book of reception like this. You're really interacting with so many lives and so many stories that kind of peer through the shards of it, as it were, of what survived in this archive, this vast archive of Arabic, Persian, Turkish, Urdu writings.
Is this work, your work, the first compilation or the first discussion of that archive at a glance? Is this the first major work on this work?
Yeah, as I mentioned, there's been a very long reception in art history of Kazvini's his cosmography, his wonders and rarities. And the reason that it's so attracted the attention of art historians is it's been, as I highlight, it's a wonderful index to talk about the circulation of ideas, right? And the way that a whole vocabulary kind of travels over time and place. But in an art historian perspective, it's also a way of highlighting the various motifs and idioms of painting and styles of painting, because there's so many examples of Kazvini's wonders and rarities in painted form. So it really is offers a wonderful historical overview of the different styles and developed in courts and regions in this large arena of Persian, Arabic, Turkish, Urdu letters. So it has been discussed in scholarly context, and certainly it's well known to specialists in the fields of Persian, Arabic, Turkish letters. And there's been great studies on Kazvini before this, but none have really tackled this broad picture, in the same way. And by that, I mean the long reception history, like put it all together and kind of tell a story of why it is that this work endured so long. And also to take it out of the museum and to view it not as single folios, but as this, as a set of readings that were developed and circulated as a kind of repertoire or script that that was legible for centuries. Nobody's really kind of taken a big picture view of what it all means and why we're, as you know, writing from the framework of modernity, why it's such an interesting or strange text to think with at that larger theoretical level. And so I hope to fill that space by introducing Kazwini, because he's almost unknown to people outside of the specialist circles of Islamic learning, but also to so introduce him to a wider audience, but also to give a kind of more fuller sense of what his work has meant and the challenges that it poses.
Many a work and many a topic are well known perhaps among specialists, and yet this podcast, the New Books Network Enterprise, exists so as to disseminate these findings to generalists, to other types of scholars, to students, to an interested public audience. And so perhaps it's a stroke of fate. Initially, I've got an invitation from your publisher to cover this book, presumably because I've covered others more central to South Asia or Indian religions. And initially I thought, well, what, you know, perhaps I should pass this off. And Marshall, who runs the New Books Network, said, no, you know, the the author chooses the book, go ahead, you know, do whatever you want to do. And I thought, okay, well, let's do it. Let's cross-post it to Islamic studies. But by the same token, by virtue of hosting it in Indian religions, without question, folks are going to hear parallels. They're going to hear intriguing material in this figure. I could think of a number of books that I've covered that are related in some way, shape, or form. And one would never make those connections were it not for these conversations.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you, who might, whether in terms of interests or subfields, et cetera, who might most benefit from this work?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that we have a book within a book, and so it touches on all these different facets, almost global in its reach. And there are detailed chapters toward the end that culminate in South Asia, where Kazwini has just a really unique reception history, and part of the story that I tell of this reception history is through the use of marginalia, the way that marginal writings on the margins of his work became a standard in South Asia. And they would include, and this is part of that global reach, you know, selections from Darshuko's writings on the Upanishads, for instance, and his writings. Darshuko, of course, the Mughal prince, known for his engagement with Sanskrit cosmology and Sanskrit learnings and Persian letters, you know, the translation of a whole variety of Sanskrit materials and discourses and Indic thought into Persian. And indeed, this book is, in many ways, Kazwini's natural history serves as a kind of emblem of natural history that becomes entirely intelligible in South Asia in Persian Urdu writings, and it's also entirely intelligible in the Ottoman Turkish, you know, context as well, and also fascinatingly enough in to kind of European writers who get access to his work in the course of the 16 and 1700. So in this period of exploration and expansion in European writings on the natural world, Kazwini also has an appearance. And so, you know, the fact that it travels in all these different arenas and has things to say about colonialism, about broad imperial networks, about the nature of cosmology and how to think with other cosmologies and how to kind of challenge the normal and the quotidian and see the world anew. These arguments have such a kind of universal appeal, right? These sensibilities of wonder. So I do feel like it certainly is rooted in a field of Islamic studies, but it also kind of branches out into this broader, almost global, certainly as Kazwini saw it, global, universal, cosmic, you know, arena and sets of implications that I think, you know, would be very appealing to a whole variety of readers.
So this is obviously a fascinating topic, but you've also just pushed out a book on it. Are you still working on this topic, or what are you working on now?
Oh, it's a great question. Take a bit of a break. Yeah. So this was, over a decade's worth of thinking and writing and traveling and going to various archives. I have a lot of other projects that are on the back burner, as it were, writing projects. One on sacred geography and space and pilgrimage. So building out of and in many ways expanding the work that I've been doing. But I think for now, this is I'm going to be certainly taking a bit of a breather from the writing for a bit and attend to a variety of other little projects. But yeah.
Take a bit of a breather and a moment to enjoy the accolades.
Thank you. Yes. Well, we'll
excellent.
See.
Well, excellent. Was there anything about the book? Obviously, I'm nothing near an Islamicist or a specialist in this field, so one hopes the questions were sufficiently engaging for this work without getting too nuts and bolts. But was there anything else about the work that you hoped we touch on today?
Yeah, thank you. So as I highlighted this reception history and that implicates colonial modernity and Orientalism, the history of Orientalism, and these stories of disenchantment. The one of the things that I was very keen on doing as well is was to think broadly about enchantment as a kind of aesthetic sensibility and also as a sensibility of how to know the world and how to be in the world. And so a lot of the writing was itself engaging with thinking with novel ways of telling stories and an academic framework or as a social intellectual historian. How do I harness the stories that I am uncovering and engaging with in a way that's meaningful and pleasurable as well? So the writing process was itself a way of actually thinking with method and theory, like what does it mean to actually write in a form that's intelligible and accessible and pleasurable and has an appeal to it. So it was also a nice experiment as well for me as a writer to think of how voice and perspective are so vital to how we tell stories. So that was part of my own agenda in writing this, was to think with the written word in creative ways and to use the power of enumeration, of lists, of anecdotes, of digressions, like in many ways, like the narrative, the tricks that are in the Arabian Nights that we see, the story of the 1001 Nights, that Kazwini's work in so many fascinating ways is connected to, because of so many of his tales actually have parallels with the Arabian Nights. And so that literary aesthetic element of the writing process was also very important to me as a scholar and someone who's been thinking with these materials, how to tell the story of these writings in a way that's legible.
It's certainly worth mentioning indeed. It's a rich literary style, which is atypical for academic books, perhaps more typical than at one point in history, but nevertheless, it's clear it's a style that befits the object of study, and it's somewhat internalized for me that the best speakers and the best authors are storytellers. Storytelling, being able to curate the information in a way that is accessible, that's entertaining, that it pulls you along. And I think your work certainly exhibits that quality, which makes it super accessible and enjoyable. And I thought it occurred to me that that was your homage to how enjoyable the object of study was.
Absolutely, that's right. And I feel like there's a responsibility as scholars to make this work accessible and to be beyond just specialists, certainly. And that's I feel when we write about in the hierarchies of writing about others and about other pasts, there's something to be said about clarity and sympathy. You know, there's so much of academic writing is structured around antipathy and antagonism towards others. You know, either it's the field that's got it wrong, or the whole ethical sensibility is problematic, or there's a whole kind of tension around how we interact with others. And so I also wanted to cultivate a sense of sympathy and with it try to imagine alternate ways of being in the world and seeing the world.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, one of the driving forces of my scholarship and podcasting and really everything that I try to do is bringing folks together. But to your point, I came across through the grapevine a scholar that had initially declined coming on the podcast, thinking that I was in a certain camp. Whether that camp was scholarly or ideological, and perhaps that scholar and others have soon learned that I will interview anybody under the sun who is producing a credible scholarship.
Yeah,
and but it speaks a tension between the modality of scholarship, which, as you say, has to do with picking apart things, picking apart ideas, factions. Certainly, in my Puranic studies scholarship, I critique other methods, certainly. And yet in this space, and in sort of the public discourse space, in the space of public intellectualism, it's a question of bringing folks together, and it's a question of making accessible. It's a question of being as inclusive in the discourse as we can.
It's a wonderful of opening up too, I feel as well, that opening up both your style as a writer and thinker and the kinds of conversations that you can have around these challenging topics too, which are topics about, you know, where we are and where we're going. There's sort of big issues baked into it. And with it, you know, our relationship to the natural world and our relationship to suffering and to each other as well in a global scale. So how to curate those conversations and bring them into a kind of broader set of arguments and stories is really a privilege to work in this field.
That's a lovely note to end on. I want to thank you for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And I'm so thrilled to be able to share with you this work.
Our pleasure for hosting you. Once again, I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and I've been speaking with Dr. Travis Zade, who is a professor at the Department of Religion at Yale University, on his fascinating new Harvard University Press publication, Wonders and Rarities, marvelous book that traveled the world and mapped the cosmos. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, stay sane, and keep contemplating the wonders of the world. Take care.